Hello, I'm Ken DeLuke, and welcome to the Turning Point Podcast, the bi-weekly program that features interesting people from all walks of life, addresses the concerns and events from the movers and shakers in your community, and provides a forum for you, the listener, to ask questions and share what keeps you up at night. To ask a question, please leave a voicemail at 312-866-7174. That's 312-866-7174, or leave an email at theturningpointpodcast.com. That's theturningpointpodcast.com. Now, your host is Mohammed Fahim, a candidate for the United States U.S. House of Representatives. Mr. Fahim.
Thank you for the introduction, Ken. And if you could please introduce our guest for tonight.
Mohammed, tonight we have a very special guest, Mr. John Counter. He has credentials in the legal arena that are beyond reproach. He got his degree from the University of Illinois in Champaign. He ran for the Illinois House of Representatives and won that campaign. He ran for the Illinois State Senate, won that campaign, and currently he's running for the 12th Circuit Court of Will County. Now, his notoriety is that he was in charge of the special grand jury for one of the most high-profile legal cases in Illinois, if not the United States, of Drew Peterson. He was the chief of the major crimes division for the Will County State's Attorney's Office. So without further ado, I introduce to you Mr. John Counter.
Thank you, Ken. And John, welcome to the Turning Point Podcast. Thank you so much for taking some time out to be with us.
Absolutely, Mohammed. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Well, that's it's our pleasure. So let's dive right in and start off by seeing who are you? Who is Mr. John Counter, and why does he want to be a judge?
Got it. Thank you so much, Mohammed. As I indicated, so I'm a Joliet native. I was born and raised in Joliet, right down on Broadway Street, and so I grew up. In a neighborhood that was kind of transitional. And, my father was a judge. He used to walk, to and from work from our house down to the courthouse every day. And my mother ran a nursing home, which was across the street from our house in Joliet. So, that was kind of where I began down on Broadway Street. And it was really a great street, to grow up on. There were a lot of different kinds of people there. And like I said, it wasn't like a gated community or anything like that. Not that there's anything wrong with those, but, we definitely had a very interesting, and diverse cast of characters, that I grew up with. And so that was kind of where I started. And then, I ended up going to Joliet Catholic High School, now JCA. I was familiar with that. That was right down the street when I was growing up. And, obviously they've moved since then. And then I went to the University of Notre Dame and then on to the wonderful U of I in Champaign for law school. Basically Joliet, born and raised and, have spent my entire life except for a brief period where I practiced law on the island of Saipan out near Guam in almost to the Philippines. Except for that time frame, I've been in Will County the entire time. And so I went out to Saipan when I got out of law school and then I came back. I ended up finding out that my younger brother, Matt, who was the baby of the family. He was diagnosed with malignant melanoma and he ended up passing a couple of years later. And so I came back, after that from the island of Saipan and then joined the Will County State's Attorney's Office not long after that. Worked briefly for the Attorney General's Office in their high-tech crimes bureau where I got a lot of training in digital forensics, the admission of computer records into courtrooms, into cases. And so that was really kind of my area of expertise was, mm-hmm. How do we get web pages, cell phone records, location information, that type of kind of digital information into court cases. And so that was kind of how I made my bones within the state's attorney's office was through that specialized training.
That's so interesting. Remember mm-hmm. in our conversation before we started the podcast, I was telling you that my son and daughter-in-law are both attorneys. And my son, obviously being a young guy that he is, he has done seminars in the stuff that you're talking about for bringing in technology into the courts.
Yep. Well, there's certainly no ignoring it. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, when I was younger and I was getting the training, I thought, oh, you know, technology is fantastic. And obviously I'm quite a bit older and wiser now. And, you know, there's definitely aspects of the technology, particularly social media and some other things where, you know, it you definitely see as you get older how what a double-edged sword, you know, technology can be. But it really comes in handy in the courtroom. As a prosecutor, I can say, you know, as a former prosecutor, I can say that unequivocally that, you know, digital evidence can be, you know, can be very helpful to figuring out what the truth is in a particular situation.
Yep. How was your experience in Saipan? I mean, that is fascinating. I haven't talked with too many attorneys who actually, you know, went out of the stateside to practice law. How did that happen to begin with?
So I was at the University of Illinois, and there was I was in the placement office one day, and I'd been scheduling, you know, meetings with law firms, and I saw an ad that was kind of hand-drawn up on the cork board, and it said, would you like to practice law in a tropical paradise? And it had, like, you know, palm tree and coconuts and et cetera on it, and it had a phone number, and it said, you know, call.
Okay.
So I ended up calling. It turned out that there was a gentleman who had graduated the law school about 5 or 6 years before me, who had maintained a very close friendship with the woman who ran the placement office after he'd graduated from U of I. And he had gone out to the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Islands, which Saipan is a part of. And he ended up being the attorney for the governor, you know, basically the gentleman who was running that. And so, you know, it's an island of about 60,000 people. So it's, you know, it's, you know, even small by city standards. But, you know, basically I called him and he said, you know, you'll definitely, you know, you'll have an interesting experience if you come out here and work. So I did. I flew 20 hours out there and I interviewed with the one large firm on island, and I decided, you know, I'm not really busy right now. So I'm going to do this because I won't do it when I'm older. So, you know, at that time I was, you know, 24 and unencumbered. And so I went out there and did about a year and a half practicing law out there.
Yeah, unencumbered and unemployed, right?
So. Exactly, right. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
What was a typical case there that you recall?
So there was a very interesting case that was going on when I was there that involved a gentleman named Larry Hillbloom, who was the H in DHL. And he was a very unique, unusual guy. And he ended up, he liked very much to fly planes, but he was too cheap he was worth almost $500 million. But he wouldn't buy his own plane. So he used to fly these kind of rickety planes. And then he would ask the pilot if he could fly for a while. Long story short, they went out and they got caught in a squall and the plane went down. He was never seen or heard from again.
Wow.
They found out afterwards that he had I'll politely put it, he had some interests that caused him to have some heirs that were kind of unknown to people at the time, whose mothers were rather young. Long story short, he had his tax attorney do his will, and the tax attorney forgot to include what's called a pretermitted heirs clause, which means that if you don't mention someone in the will, they're basically don't inherit anything. And so there were a number of children who ended up, obviously their parents were the ones who came forth, but they ended up litigating, for his estate after he disappeared. So when I was there, the firm that I worked for was handling probate work on behalf of the foundation that was managing his estate. So I ended up doing just a whole lot for that year and a half of legal research into probate cases, you know, nationwide, and what happens when, you know, you have people, basically, you know, when you have these people coming forth to say, this is my father, and I'm entitled to part of his estate. So it was fascinating. One person indicated, I was almost never in the courtroom, I was just doing legal research, but someone who was in the courtroom on a fairly regular basis said that at times the greed in the air was so thick you could cut it with a knife. So it was very, very interesting, you know, because it was a very small courtroom in a small island, you know, out on a remote corner of the planet.
If it was only 60,000 people, half of them may be related to the guy. So
You know, and they were his heirs were coming from everywhere, the Philippines, you know, Thailand. There were all sorts of different places that his heirs were potential heirs.
Person. John, thank you very much for recalling that. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mom.
You've been listening to the Turning Point Podcast. Our goal is to present you with interesting people from all walks of life. So if you know someone who's got a fascinating story to tell, please give them our number, 312-866-7174. Or you can just leave a message on our website, theturningpointpodcast.com. We'll be back right after this message. Hey, folks. Many of you have heard in the news recently that Congress has passed and the president has signed a bill that provides substantial funds for green energy. You may ask, how does that affect me? Well, the average homeowner, now if your home qualifies, could have a complete solar power system installed on your home at no upfront cost. Having solar on your roof and not drawing power from the grid could save you as much as 50% of what you are currently paying on your current electric bill. Not only that, but you'd be protected from the excessive electric company rate increases that are expected in the near future. If you are interested to see if you qualify, please call me at 312-617-8979, 312-617-8979, and leave a message or shoot me an email at ken.deluc, that's D-E-L-U-C, at sunrun.com. I'll try to help you take advantage of this great opportunity.
Blue Fathoms Television, a new entertainment venue, is located on the Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV, and Android TV. Blue Fathoms TV is the place for vintage movies, television shows, and cartoons from a bygone era. You can also find us on the internet at www.blue6tv.com and on Facebook at Blue Fathoms Television. Enjoy Academy Award-winning films featuring legendary actors. So please stop by and catch our programming as we are always updating. Blue Fathoms Television on the Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV, and Android TV platforms.
Okay, welcome back to the Turning Point Podcast. Tonight, our guest is John Connor, a gentleman who's running for the 12th Circuit Court of Illinois. That's the Will County District. John, I had a question for you. You mentioned that you were in charge of the special grand jury for the Drew Peterson case, and obviously that's one of the most highly recognized cases in jurisprudence. Did you find, because of that pressure and all that media attention, did that put any kinks into your process as you were trying to take care of that?
I mean, it definitely introduced wrinkles, into the proceedings, because we had things happening that, you know, in any other murder case that I would have prosecuted that did not receive that level of notoriety, not everyone would kind of know what was going on with the investigation all the time. But we ran into, you know, we lost the element of surprise in many situations because, you know, press stories or media coverage would kind of end up, you know, basically putting things out into the public realm while we were still conducting an investigation, during that time frame. So that definitely made things unusual compared to, you know, many of the other murders that I prosecuted for the state's attorney's office.
Well, John, I mean, obviously everyone was following that case very closely, and so was I. Was there any kind of personal threat to you by anybody? I mean, we all heard about the silence of the blue wall and stuff like that. Was that anything of concern?
No, not at all. Not in that particular, not in that particular case at all. As you are well aware, there was, you know, a subsequent investigation and prosecution for a threat that he made to the state's attorney, and that, you know, obviously that came later. But no, there was, Drew was. there were definitely, you know, people who were friends with Drew, but there was never anything with the blue wall with that particular investigation that I was ever aware of. So no, but obviously he did, you know, he did end up targeting the state's attorney at a different
time. That's where I was going with that, because, you know, that was pretty much in the news also for a long time. Oh boy. So, but do you think you're going to find Stacey Peterson's body anytime or not?
That's one of my biggest disappointments from that case, is that we were never able to allow, you know, Cassandra and the rest of the family to bury Stacey. I do believe at some point that will occur, but, you know, I have no insight into when that will be. That was one of the more unfortunate aspects, you know, of the case, is, you know, at least Kathleen Savio's family got to bury her. They know where she's buried, et cetera. And so I think for families of those who are missing or disappeared, and they don't have that closure. So that's, you know, that's definitely a sad thing and a big disappointment.
Let's talk a little bit about the Hickory Street stranglings and the Christopher Vaughn family, you know, annihilator case. Do you remember anything about those? Is there something that you want to share with us?
Yeah, Hickory Street, that was one of the cases where we're working on that. You know, that actually was one of the cases where I started thinking about other types of public service, for instance, the legislature. And part of the reason for that is that the Hickory Street case was one of those cases where you could really see that, if just a couple of different things were different, if people had just made slightly small decisions differently, you know, that would have never taken place. And that's not every murder that I prosecuted by any stretch. Some situations seem more inevitable than others in terms of, you know, how something reaches that point of that type of tragedy. But that was one of those cases where really, you know, just a couple of different decisions by the people involved, a little bit of luck on behalf, and that one doesn't happen. And that is what really got me thinking about, you know, how can we utilize our resources in a way to try to prevent, you know, those types of things from happening in the first place.
So Josh Minor, if I remember correctly, had an insanity plea, right, for that?
No, I don't remember exactly. I can't recall offhand exactly what the pleadings were. That he did, I believe at one point there was a fitness examination.
Right. He wanted a sanity evaluation like 4 years after the murders.
Right. And that's something that's, I don't want to say it's totally routine, but it is not uncommon for defense attorneys to request, you know, an evaluation if they see things in their communications with their client that, you know, cause them to question things. So, so that's not really unusual. Go ahead.
No. I was just thinking about what a fascinating career you have had. I mean, you've run into some of the strangest situations that you could, in a human being's life. Growing up in Joliet, John, what was Joliet like when you were growing up compared to what is Joliet now? Do you see, what differences do you see?
When I was growing up in Joliet, you know, we were just starting to kind of lose some of the heavier industry, and, you know, some of the jobs were kind of going away. And we use the term, you know, Rust Belt. We were kind of heading into that, because a lot of things that were kind of staples of manufacturing and jobs in the community were going away, whether it was Caterpillar, the Army, the munitions depot. There were, you know, just a lot of different, industries that were downsizing or were moving, you know, overseas, those types of things. So it was great for me growing up because, you know, we still had a lot of those industries. I think now I'm very optimistic for the future. I think those things are coming back. We had Lion Electric, which came in while I was a state senator, absolutely wonderful company. So we are seeing some optimism, but there was a time there, in the 80s and 90s where things were things were rough, you know, so it's a little different than when I grew up now, but I still think it has, you know, what I call that, you know, it's got that there, that uniqueness. There's a Joliet uniqueness that's hard to describe. So,
You may be aware or not, John, but I am one of the co-founders of the Midwest Reshoring Initiative. Along with Harry Moser. Reshoring is the opposite of offshoring. So about 11 years back now, Harry and I started this Reshoring Initiative, which is a national initiative now. And we have gone around training manufacturers, especially how to use a new software program that Harry wrote called the Total Cost of Ownership Estimator, which really tells them that when they offshore production, they're really not taking into account a lot of factors that should go towards the cost of the product.
Got it. And, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I remember being at a presentation about economic, you know, put on by the Will County Center for Economic Development, in which they talked about companies that had gone to other states and then found out that some of the incentives did not add up to, you know, the bottom line savings that they thought where it was going to add up to. And then they ended up coming back here to Illinois. So that's a wonderful initiative. That is great. I mean, anything that, you know, helps us bring industry back to Will County is absolutely a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I mean, our estimates then were that if 5% of manufacturing comes back from overseas, it'll create 100,000 jobs in Illinois every year.
Yep. Then that certainly would be amazing. We, you know, that certainly would improve lives for all Illinoisans, which, you know, that's what I was trying to do in the legislature. And that's what we should all be, you know, striving to do.
Yep.
To, and
especially now with the supply chain issues that we've been seeing recently, a lot of manufacturers are taking a second look at, like, hey, you know, we need to come back over here now.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. Yeah. To have to get all, you know, especially. Well, obviously anything related to national security, but just anything that we need, you know, for you know, life and health here in the U.S., we need to be able to make that stuff here. So,
okay, sounds good. Thank you so much, John, for everything so far. Let's take a quick break and come back on the other side of the break for our final segment.
Okay. You're listening to the Turning Point Podcast. Give us a call at 312-866-7174 if there's something that keeps you up at night, or there's an interesting character you would like to share with class. I encourage you to please call me. This podcast is for all of you. We'll be back after these messages. You know, it's been said that life is too short to drink cheap wine. What a better gift than a nice bottle of wine. Now, I know what you're thinking. When I give a gift of that special wine and that special occasion where it's used arises, how will they remember it was from me? Bob the Wine Guy has the answer. Bob the Wine Guy specializes in corporate gifts, wine tasting fundraisers, 19th hole golf tournament gifts, and business referral gifts. He's been celebrating over 25 years of matching wonderful people to their exquisite wines and spirits. When you give the gift of wine, your name or your company's name will be personalized, get this, right on the bottle. So on that special occasion, that lucky recipient will know exactly who helped to make it special. Bob the Wine Guy can be reached at 217-415-0966. That's 217-415-0966. Or check out his website at www.pouritagainsam.com. Hey, folks. Many of you have heard in the news recently that Congress has passed and the president has signed a bill that provides substantial funds for green energy. You may ask, how does that affect me? Well, the average homeowner, now if your home qualifies, could have a complete solar power system installed on your home at no upfront cost. Having solar on your roof and not drawing power from the grid could save you as much as 50% of what you are currently paying on your current electric bill. Not only that, but you'd be protected from the excessive electric company rate increases that are expected in the near future. If you are interested to see if you qualify, please call me at 312-617-8979, 312-617-8979, and leave a message or shoot me an email at ken.deluke, that's D-E-L-U-C, at sunrun.com. I'll try to help you take advantage of this great opportunity. Welcome back to the Turning Point Podcast. If you'd like to share something with us, our phone number is 312-866-7174. 7174. Our guest tonight is John Connor. He's running for the 12th Circuit Court in Illinois, which is Will County. And Mohammed?
Hey, thank you, Ken. So, John, before we go further, I wanted to kind of take a step back and talk to you about the Christopher Vaughn case that that you were involved in. I know that you know he is he was convicted of the murder of his wife Kimberly and the couple's three children. This was in June of 2007, all because he wanted to go live in some wilderness somewhere, and he's in the right place. It's not a wilderness, but what can you tell us about that case?
One of the most interesting things that happened to me as a result of there were a couple of interesting things that happened on that case. One was at one point I was investigating another case, and that case involved an Xbox. Mm-hmm. And I did not have an investigator locally that handled Xbox forensics. So I called Microsoft to ask them if they had anyone locally who was an Xbox digital forensics expert that I could, you know, hire in order to obtain evidence in this particular case. And they said, well, we had someone there, but you have him locked up right now. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not understanding. And they said, his name's Christopher Vaughn, and I think he's in custody in your jail right now. And so that was a very unusual situation. I mean, he was a, you know, very highly paid forensics expert at a consulting company in Chicago at that time. So, but I, you know, so it was very strange to, you know, have things come full circle when I called Microsoft to make that request, and that was what they told me. So that case was very unusual in many different ways. Plus we sent a code. He came up with a code in the jail, and we sent it to Quantico in order to get it and to get it deciphered, which was I've never done that in any other case. So that was very unusual.
Man, what an interesting life you have led, John. Well, I'm going to get into our final segment, and this is going to be shotgun questions coming to you. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm just going to go straight boom, boom, boom on this. Okay.
Sure.
Gun control. Where do you stand on that?
So, I believe in the Second Amendment. It's part of our Constitution. I also believe that background checks and ensuring that, guns don't get into the hands of people that we know are going to misuse them is a legitimate goal of legislation. And that's the way that I voted when I was a state representative. And my inquiry was always this: we need someone, either the CDC or someone else, to investigate gun violence and try and figure out some, you know, least restrictive methods that we can use that get us less violence, basically. And in order to figure that out, you have to research. And that was one of my biggest problems with parts of the gun lobby, where they did not want to fund research that would tell us the least restrictive way, the most constitutionally sound way that we can try to reduce gun violence. So, well, you know, that to me is kind of common sense.
Sure. The city of Highland Park today voted on some restrictions as far as, high capacity magazines are concerned, and some of the, automatic weapons. This is like coming in when I was driving in, I was listening to it, so I don't have all the details on it. But is that something that you think Will County should be looking at?
You know, that's something that's going to be up to legislators. They're going to have to make sure that it's constitutionally sound. And, you know, obviously, as a judge, I can never indicate, how I would rule in a particular case. But the bottom line is that, you know, policy is a legislative function. And so, you know, that's really our board members, our city council members. Those are the people who need to weigh, obviously, our rights versus the ways in which we can make our cities safer. And so they really need to apply some solutions, I think, that are going to be creative and that are going to address kind of the heart of the problem that we're facing.
Okay. Roe versus Wade. Do you think that we need more justices on the Supreme Court to balance what's happening?
So I'm just going to cite to what I voted for. I voted for SB 25, which was the Reproductive Health Act back in 2019. And at the time I had people telling me, you know, it's too much. It's, you don't need to worry about Roe, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, obviously time has not borne out that lack of concern. I will follow the law in Illinois. I'm just glad that I voted on the law in Illinois to protect women's reproductive freedom. I trust women, and I don't know that putting prosecutors and off in law enforcement into, you know, women's health clinics is the right way to go from a policy perspective.
Okay, sounds good. Healthcare reform, that is something that is very close to my heart. In fact, over the weekend, I was at a party and happened to run into a gentleman who is a chief sustainability officer in a major hospital. And that kind of piqued my interest. And I said, hey, what does the chief sustainability officer do? And he started walking me through what his role is. And, I'm going to meet him again and have a closer conversation with him. But the bottom line that I came away with is that his job is to make sure that a person entering point A in the hospital goes to point B and goes to point C, and the process is smooth throughout. But then he also said that, oh, I also have to pay attention to the bottom line of the hospital. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, if we can release a patient after 3 days, we don't want to keep him for 5 days. And that is the conversation I'm going to continue with them, is to who is making the healthcare decisions in these hospitals now? Are these the bean counters, or is the doctors? Should they be, making those decisions? What do you think?
That's a very interesting question. And again, it is interesting when you're running for judge, policy is not really what you work on as a judge. You follow the law as the law stands, in Illinois. I think, just from my personal opinion, I don't think that your bottom line necessarily is going to be negatively impacted by making people healthier. I think it's interesting that he mentioned that, because, how do you do that in a way that doesn't, basically force people out of the hospital before they're totally ready to be there, et cetera, et cetera. So, obviously, I don't think that medical decisions, should be made by, as you call, I don't want to use the term, but, actuarials maybe would be the term.
Yeah, let's say those decisions should not be made by the chief sustainability officers.
Well, I certainly hope the doctors are making the decisions on that. Okay. Yeah, not officers. So.
Sounds good. John, thank you very much for your time so far. Voting rights. I know that, that is a hard button issue across the nation right now. What do you think?
It's interesting to me. I grew up in a political house, and my father was always encouraging people to vote. So it's very strange to me, and encouraging more people to be registered, making sure that people were able to get to the polls. So it's kind of strange to me now to see this emphasis that is, on trying to shrink the number of people who are getting out to the polls. I mean, a sustainable democracy is only as good as, the ability of its members to vote and decide its future. You certainly would think that everyone, regardless of party or affiliation or anything like that, would want to expand the franchise and make sure, that it is fair, and also make sure that it is fraud free. But the best way that I have found to figure out whether there's problems with the process is go talk to your county clerk, go make inquiry, find out how the process works, and find out if there's any issues. And I found that's very easy. I was at a testing of the counting machines at the county clerk's office. It was fascinating, and they answered every question that I had. And it was open to the public. Anybody could go. So absolutely, if you have questions about voting or the process, I think you should just go, straight to where it occurs, through your local county.
And, I've always found, Lawrence Daly Ferry to be very approachable at the Will County. And, mm-hmm. you know, they are doing a phenomenal job of keeping the system running properly.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, I was very impressed when I went to that that particular seminar. So.
Sounds good, John. Thank you so much for joining us, folks. My guest tonight on the Turning Point podcast is John Connor, who's running for the 12th Circuit in Will County as a judge. And John has been a state senator. John has been a state representative. And John, before we wrap up, what keeps you up at night?
So actually, you know, some of the things we kind of obliquely referenced, I am a big fan of accurate information. I was a history major, and, you know, it's kind of amazing to me that nowadays we have access to more information than we've ever had in the history of mankind. And yet we have more inaccurate information out there, in my opinion, than I have ever seen, you know, as an adult before. So that's what like I spoke at the beginning, it's that double-edged nature of technology. What I have found and what keeps me up at night is that, you know, people sometimes will not take 2 minutes to fact check a particular story or something that they've heard that maybe gets them angry. And so I really wish people would, you know, fight against misinformation and just make sure that the information that you're getting is accurate. Because, you know, I always remember from A Christmas Carol, you know, at the end after the ghost of Christmas Future, and the two children emerge from under his robes, and it's, you know, one is want and one is ignorance. And, you know, they say ignorance is the more dangerous of the two. And so that always stuck with me, you know, because misinformation can start wars. It can cause horrific things to happen. And so that's, you know, something that keeps me up at night. I think we need to make sure that we're getting accurate information.
Thank you, John. I cannot agree more with you on that. And one final question before we wrap up. What was the turning point in your life that got you out from practicing law into making sure that the laws are written properly in the state legislatures and now running as a judge to make sure that those guys are doing a good job at the state legislature when they write those laws?
My real turning point for kind of getting out and doing things was actually the loss of my brother. You know, there's kind of two phases to my life. There was before I lost, you know, before we lost Matt, and then after we lost Matt. And I think, you know, anyone who's been touched by tragedy, you know, in their immediate family, they've gone through something similar, but it really did kind of impact me. It caused me to be probably a little bit more attuned to other people's suffering after I, you know, had gone through that particular loss. And that is what caused me, you know, to kind of head towards how can we change things to make things better for everybody that we share this country with, that we share the county, every place with. You know, instead of looking at life as a zero sum game where you're always trying to edge out someone else, and that if one person is doing well, then you're kind of losing by comparison. You know, that was what really got me motivated to try to help and to see things beyond, you know, whatever was going on in my life at the time.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. And you just said that you were a history major. Is that where the name Circe comes from?
Circe, yeah. Yes, yeah. Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I did not know Circe was a character in the Game of Thrones show. I've watched it now, but I hadn't watched it before we named our dog. So I was going back to, you know, the sorceress from the Odyssey who turned Odysseus's men into pigs in the story. But later people were like, oh, how could you do that? You know, that's a horrible character from Game of Thrones. And I have to explain to them that, you know, that's not where the name Circe came from. But, you know, yeah, very, very funny reactions from people to that.
Okay, wonderful.
Hey, Jan, I really want to thank you. I mean, it was a wonderful segment here. I really appreciate your background. It was extremely interesting, and I do hope to see you on the bench in the near future.
Thank you very much, Ken. This has been very enjoyable, and you guys do a great job of having people on and making it a pleasant experience, you know, which is great. So.
Okay, folks, that's John Connor. He's running for the 12th Circuit Court. So please get out and vote. And we will see you next time on the Turning Point podcast. If you want to leave a suggestion or ask a question, 312-866-7174. Mohammed, take it out.
And you can find more information about John and who he is and how you can be a part of his campaign if you go to connorforjudge.com. And we hope to see you on the bench one day. Mr. Connor, I hope to call you, Your Honor, pretty soon after November. Thank you very much, Ken, and thank you very much, John.